Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is rather humorous. The DC circus. Could all former presidents and vice presidents please check their garages to see if they have any classified documents?
I'm really pulling for Dan Quayle to come up with something, huh? Who's your one that you want?
The National Archives sending a letter to reps for former presidents and vice presidents from the last six administrations covered by the Presidential Records Act, which asks if... you could please review your residences and private office spaces to see if you inadvertently, of course, because how else would it be, can have presidential records that are required by law to turn over to the National Archives. The responsibility to comply with the PRA, Presidential Records Act, does not diminish after the end of administration, according to the letter. Therefore, we request you conduct an assessment of any materials held outside of the National Archives that relate to the administration for which you serve as a designated representative to determine whether bodies of materials previously assumed to be personal in nature might inadvertently contain presidential or vice presidential records subject to the Presidential Records Act, whether classified or unclassified, and so on and so on and so forth. But the problem is, based on what we have, what we understand to be true, what has been reported about some of the documents with classified markings found at the Biden compound, you would have to include all United States senators too, because some of the documents date back to his time as United States Senator.
Yeah, that's
particularly
right.
Senators on the perhaps on the Senate Intel Committee.
312-642-5600 is our number. You can always reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know what we could use?
What?
Here, I think. We could use the artistic talents of Hunter Biden, sort of provide a moment here of artistic commentary on this classified records imbroglio. I have to get this in. Hunter Biden's art dealer, Georges Berger, has claimed that Hunter.
What? Oh, no.
Will be one of the most consequential artists of the century. The blow artist, Hunter Biden, and I'm not referring to his drug issue or whatever he's doing in his bedroom. He's a blow artist.
I mean,
he blows paint on canvas, right?
We tried it here. Sean Thompson was in for you, and we all did the blow art thing. And
I bet you did.
I mean, it was a good show. It was a show to remember. Quinn won the contest, hands down. I think Three Suns Over a Coronavirus Moon was the name of his painting.
Yeah.
We'll tweet it out later. But
well, that's he has a little bit of an advantage because he used to blow glass in Brazil, and and glass won't stop calling. Hi-o.
Oh, hey. But I mean that's not artistic
George
talent. Please,
Berger.
Yes, go on, dear.
To my point and to his point, okay. I'm just adopting this. I represent Hunter Biden because I feel that not only his art merits my representation, but because his personal narrative, which gives birth to his art. He was conceived in art. He births. Okay. It's very much needed in the world right now, and it is. So how about an artist rendering of this sort of abstraction of the handling of classified information? I just think comment from Hunter, and again, through the medium that will be most impactful, that would be his art, would be warranted in this. His is a story of perseverance.
Oh, right. I mean, he's such
Hunter's
a mastermind.
Hunter's story reflects what I believe is the beauty of humanity. Judge not by the fall, oh no, but by having the strength to rise up, by having the character required to change and the courage to do it. Hunter Biden's art reflects all of that and more. His art gives us hope. It reminds us that tomorrow brings a new day, a new beginning, and, yes, a new possibility.
I mean, I'm going to cry now.
I mean, and when you think of Hunter Biden, tell me the words character and courage don't come to mind.
Oh, yes. He's a man of sound character. So he's an artist and he's an energy czar. I mean, this man is brilliant. How does he have the time to do it all? If any of you are watching at home, I've got Quinn's blow art here. Three Flowers Under the COVID Sun is the name. And if any of you want to purchase it, you can call us and let us know.
Yeah.
Beautiful. It's right here, so you can see it on the camera.
I mean, Hunter's blow art's going for $75,000 a pop, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and who's buying his art?
A lot
Somebody
of
who wants
communists.
Access to his dad, maybe?
Yeah.
Just
He's
insane.
Very big in the Chinese communist market. Yeah,
what about
very
the Ukrainian
big.
Market? How's he tapping into that one yet, too?
Yeah.
I mean, he's so brilliant.
He belongs to no one. He belongs to everyone. Hunter Biden is in all of us.
Oh, right.
And has been in many of us, apparently, according to his laptop. All right. Ooh. So I wanted to get to something else, too, because the classified documents that have been seized by the actual president, or from the actual president, well, seized, that implies an aggressive posture by the FBI. The classified documents the FBI was willing to accept from the Biden administration.
Democrats get searched, Republicans, their homes get raided. Okay, Dan, we got to know the difference here.
And so, Tom Cotton and some Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee would like to see the documents that were seized from both former President Trump as well as those that were politely handed over by President Biden. And the Director of National Intelligence is saying no. And so Tom Cotton is saying, okay, well, we're not going to take up any of Biden's federal judiciary nominees until we see those documents. So it's getting a little chippy there inside the Beltway.
Here's the senator.
Until the administration stops stonewalling Congress, there will be pain as a consequence for them.
Good. Good for him. Set some landmarks. I mean, set some rules, I should say. Excuse me.
But I got to tell you, the story goes off on so many different tangents. This is an interesting one since Cotton invoked judicial nominees. There were some judicial nominees before the Senate Judiciary Committee recently, a handful of federal district court nominees. And Senator John Kennedy is one of the lead interrogators when it comes to judicial nominees. And this is important because, as we've discussed, Biden is actually as successful as Trump was in populating the judiciary with his appointees and getting them confirmed. Biden has been even more successful. And maybe some Republicans, even though they're in the minority there in the Senate, maybe they want to start pumping the brakes and raising the profile on the quality of some of these nominees. John Kennedy did so, I wouldn't say inadvertently. Maybe he knew who he was dealing with. Listen to this exchange between Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana and a Biden judicial nominee named Charnel Jelkengren from Washington State. Very telling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations to all of you. Judge, on the far end, tell me what Article 5 of the Constitution does.
Article 5 is not coming to mind at the moment.
Okay. Hmm. How about Article 2?
Oh, no. Come on, honey.
Neither is Article 2.
Ow! Okay. Do you know what purposivism is?
Oh, boy. That's a big stretch.
In my 12 years as an assistant attorney general and my 9 years serving as a judge, I was not faced with that precise question. We are the highest trial court in Washington State, so I'm frequently faced with issues that I'm not familiar with, and I thoroughly review the law, our research, and apply the law to the facts presented to me.
Well, you're going to be faced with it as if you're confirmed. I can assure you of that.
Article 5 deals with amending the Constitution. Okay, maybe you don't recall Article 5 offhand. Article 2 relates to the executive branch, the organization of the executive branch. What? Purposivism is, it's a sounds like a very complicated legal term or something. It just means interpreting statute consistent with the objective rationale behind the law. That's all. And the fact that she said, well, I the highest trial court in Washington State, assistant attorney general, right. That's an indictment of Washington State's justice system. But it's also a reminder about the quality of a lot of these judges. Legal scholars, they're not. Intellectuals. Intellectuals, they're not. That exchange, which won't get nearly the play it deserves, is troubling at multiple levels, and it should be a reminder, as we need a reminder in Illinois with Cook County Circuit Court judges and the Illinois Supreme Court. But the quality of the minds on these courts, just because you put on a robe doesn't mean you know what you're talking about. Because I was an assistant AG. I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I was this prosecutor. Yeah. What have we seen in terms of performance? Now, some of people in those positions are indeed intellectuals and scholars and more than competent and thinkers. But a lot of them aren't. And frankly, that's what a confirmation process is supposed to flesh out. So for reasons that have nothing to do with classified documents, I'm happy to hear Tom Cotton using judicial nominees as the leverage against the administration to see those documents. They should be slowing down those judicial nominees altogether for reasons that relate to their competency to be on the federal bench. Not that Ms. Jel Kengren wouldn't have a lot of similarly talented colleagues on the bench that she would be joining. But, that is wild. And it tells you a lot about the mentality of particularly the leftist lawyers in this country. The Constitution is something that's referenced, that's invoked when you go through a pro forma oath, but it's not something I know anything about or need to. And if somebody asks me what Article 2 is, well, then I'll just Google it. There's somebody who's put a lot of thought into constitutional law.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Chicago's very own Willie Wilson, candidate for mayor, was on with Tucker Carlson last night talking about, well, what else would you be talking about to a national audience with respect to Chicago other than...
It's crime?
Violence, right. And played Tucker Willie's clip from the debate, the ABC 7 debate a week ago Thursday, where he talked about taking the handcuffs off police and having them chase down criminals like rabbits as needed, contrasting himself from Lori Lightfoot and the defund, decarcerate crowd, which was what was mainly on stage during that debate, who oppose, you know, police chases, whether on foot or in cars, really oppose policing in general. Here's what Willie had to say.
Well, here's what I meant. I lost a 20-year-old son. He was murdered by a gun. These people need to be caught. Too many restriction on the police department. We need to take the handcuffs off the police officer and put them on the people who's actually doing it. And it need to stop now. This particular mayor that we have right now just keep coming up with excuses. But people keep dying on the street. Nobody doing anything about it. But excuses. So, no, when we become mayor of the city of Chicago, we're going to put a stop to this crime. We're going to take them back, our police officer, men and women, and get the job done. I'm tired of it. I don't want to see no other family go through what I've been through, the loss of a son or lose a daughter or something of that nature. We're going to stop it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Simple question, because these are the only two candidates that are really talking about restoring policing to the city of Chicago. Who do you believe or who do you trust more on this issue, Vallis or Willie Wilson? There's only two candidates that are saying those things. So two of the nine, Vallis or Willie Wilson. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. And I think the folding in of the... loss that his family experienced. By the way, his son wasn't murdered by a gun. He was murdered by somebody who used a gun, but I'll give him a pass. Those are included in ads he's running now, too. I mean, you know, it's powerful, obviously.
I know. And we've had him on countless times, and he never mentioned that before. You know, I mean, have you ever heard about it before besides the ad that he waited a long time? I think to tell his story.
I think he actually did mention it when we spoke with him 4 years ago when he ran. He hasn't talked about it a lot, and
it's painful.
For obvious reasons. Yeah, that's fair. I'm not forcing him to or suggesting he should, but he's chosen to do so now. To sort of present as somebody who knows what he's talking about, and not just because he is so ingrained in the black church community and in other ways. So
David
he's using
Brown
it now.
David Brown lost his son too.
Yes, David Brown.
Gun violence.
Well,
but that was a poor of a police shooting, and his son was
a criminal,
and shot at police, and they fired back.
A little bit different. Awful. I mean, Paul it's still Vallis, terrible, you know, but it's different, right?
Paul Vallis lost his son to addiction.
Understand. I mean, I'm not saying that this is a competition to see who has suffered the most tragedy. I mean, it's all terrible, and it does inform their understanding of these issues in a very personal way. I definitely concede that point. But ultimately, it still comes down to the question of, you know, I mean, who do you think is more of a swashbuckler when it comes to the established order and the identity, the poisonous identitarian political culture in Chicago? Who's more likely to buck it? In furtherance of public safety.
I think Paul Vallis. I trust him more than Willie Wilson. Willie Wilson's a wonderful man, but Paul Vallis has been in the political pit before. I think he knows how it works, and I think that he'll come in hitting the ground running, whereas Willie Wilson's got to learn everything. I mean, he's a newbie. But I don't know. We might need that. People might like that. Hmm. Somebody who's not in the swamp, so to speak. Who do you trust more, Dan?
I'll reserve my answer for a moment. Okay. Joe in his car, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. God bless. I would vote for Willie Wilson.
Why?
I know. Well, because I've been following him for quite some time. I used to listen to another morning radio station back in the day, and he was on several times. He stuck to his guns for at least the past 6-7 years that I've heard him speak. The only thing that I did disagree with him on is when he did talk about reparations for former slave owners. But the rest of the stuff, he's spot on. And the fact that Paul Vallis is a good person, I got nothing bad against him, just the fact that he is a political individual that's been in the realm for quite some time. And I still hold him accountable for the degradation of the Chicago public schools and other places where he's gone with his ideologies of, he actually started the indoctrination of the CRT back in the day with all equity and all this stuff. Yeah,
you think he's responsible for that?
Amy, look back in the day when he was the public school, Chicago public school leader there, and look at the programs that he implemented. It was the start. I'm not saying it was CRT full blown, but it was the beginning of the. It was the beginning of the end. Yeah, I hear your IV business. Yeah, for the elitist kids and all this business.
Oh, elitist kids? Watch your mouth. We're not elitist kids. Seriously.
For the kids.
These are kids who couldn't get into selective enrollment schools that have another option. Elitist kids.
Amy,
come to school
with me. I don't want
to
fight with you about me. I know he's your friend and all that stuff, and I got nothing against him. But I'm going to tell you, when I was on the board, they ran things through on the Chicago public school side back in 2000, go look it up, and you'll see what he did.
Wait a second. Did you say when you were on the Board of Ed?
I was at Oklahoma Community High School.
Oh, okay.
From
1999 to 2010. So I know what I'm talking about with this stuff. I might not have presented it properly, but if you go back and look around 2002, what was come down in the Chicago public schools was the start of all this, softness, let's just call it that. How about that?
Thanks
well,
for the
call. Different than CRT. But yeah, Joe, we're going to have him on next Wednesday, and I will ask him about that.
Mm-hmm.
Next Wednesday at 7 o'clock, he will be here.
You know, the whole he knows the system argument, that cuts both ways, right?
It does.
I know the system, so I understand how things work. Well, does that mean you're going to operate in a way consistent with how things have always been done? Because this is how the system...
No.
Are you going to be beholden to the system, or are you an agent for system change?
He's going to change the culture, Dan.
Yeah, I know what
you
think,
and
I know what he says, but that's a larger question for somebody who's been in the system for so long, and for the most part, during his time there. And I understand it's difficult, because your job would be on the line. He was not a pronounced reformer. He was somebody who was part of the system. He was not an agent for system change. He was part of the system. If you go back and look at his campaigns for governor in 2002 in the Dem primary with Burris and Blagojevich, when he ran with Pat Quinn in 2014 as his LG candidate, you're not going to find the rhetoric of an agent for system change. Ron, Southside.
Hey, Danny, Amy, give me a break. Paul Vallis. Dan, you're not going to hear anything about change, because that's not what he is about.
He is
the system.
He is now.
Oh, he is. like they say, oh, he got religious. Yeah. Well, but guess what? I'm not falling for it. Amy, did you say he's going to be on next week?
Next Wednesday at 7 o'clock. 7:07.
You know what? I'll listen.
Okay, listen, Ron.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for the call, Ron.
We'll take your calls afterward.
Craigmont Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy.
Mont Greenwood, this should be Paul Vallis base camp here, Mont Greenwood.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to give you the reason why Vallis is second choice to Willie Wilson. Willie Wilson is basically not a politician. He don't have any of the polish. He doesn't talk, talk all the talk. And I believe he'd be like Trump coming in there, man. He's going to do some cleaning house. He's serious business, and there's going to be a lot less talk and bullcrap coming in there with Willie Wilson. Dallas, it's like, all right, he's okay, but second place. He's, that's pretty much the way I see it.
Tucker Carlson said when he introed Willie on his show yesterday, our preferred candidate for mayor. Ooh, interesting. You know, for all this talk about Brandon Johnson, the CTU candidate, coming around the corner at the turn and staging a late rally, maybe there's still a chance that Willie Wilson does that.
I'd much rather have Willie Wilson than Brandon Johnson.
Well, yeah.
If he wins, I might consider moving because that is going to be some scary stuff, folks. He is in bed with the CTU. That's my nemesis. I can't stand them.
Phil, Maryville, Indiana.
Hey, morning. I'd have to say Dan changed my mind. I went from Willie Wilson to Lori Lightfoot. It seriously isn't bad enough in this city for a change. We need her back in, and people need to get what they voted for.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Phil. It's kind of a bit of a two-step, right? I mean, you can push for Willie Wilson or Paul Vallis in the primary, and then if neither one makes it, or if Willie doesn't make it, then you can say, okay, well, Vallis isn't running any campaign that can win, so what's the point anyway? Let's just throw in with Lori Lightfoot and cheerlead the maximum punishment required for more people to feel like it's time to do things differently in Chicago, because clearly that's not the case at present. We'll see. But you can, make a claim for improvement in the primary, and if that's rejected, then it's maximum punishment time. Tom, Deer Park.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I would pretty much echo all of Amy's comments on Paul Vallis, and nothing against Willie. But Paul, regardless of what he didn't do in previous campaigns, he's going to run on that now. He knows the system. He knows where all the levers are. And the only thing I would add, obviously, I don't vote in the city, but Amy, let him know I've got a couple of votes at Bohemian National, a couple at Graceland, and a good two dozen at Suburban All Saints. So we're here to help.
Okay,
Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah. I wonder why a never Trumper would be so attracted to.
Okay,
Paul
easy.
Vallis.
All right.
Sandra on Northwest Side.
Yes, Paul Vallis is good for the IB. He was good for the charter schools.
Yep.
However, he missed out on a good percent of the kids by, along with Chico and Daley, very political, three, who took out vocational ed. And as soon as the test scores started to jump down, not up, Paul Vallis jumped ship with Chico, left. So, you missed out. And I think he cheated a lot of these kids that are on the street right now. I really do.
Thanks for the call, Sandra. Yeah, he mentions, when he and Gary Chico ran CPS, he mentions that a lot. Gary Chico, with due respect, I mean, I personally interacted with the guy. He's a fine guy, smart guy, he's a good attorney. Just like Paul Vallis, smart guy, capable guy, but he's a technocrat. Gary Chico is no agent for change. So when they were reimagining CPS, how did that go? One was supposedly an education revolutionary, Paul Vallis, while Gary Chico was a tool of the Daley administration. How did that work?
Well, now he's pro school choice.
That story doesn't hold up. Yeah, but past performance is an indicator of future performance when it comes to your portfolio manager. But past behavior in politics often is a indicator of future behavior in politics. That's all I'm saying. Epiphanies are somewhat rare. They happen. They happen. Change of heart, change of attitude, they happen. But they're exceedingly rare, particularly here.
You know what I'm so sick of hearing is, oh, he's a white guy, he's not going to win. Oh, so all white men just quit your jobs now because you don't deserve anything because you're a white male. stop it. I was at yoga the other day with a firefighter, and he was saying, well, I'm going to go for Willie because Paul's never going to win because white dudes can't make it.
Come on.
What kind of argument is that?
Well, it doesn't sound like he was making the argument that it should be that way. He's making the argument that it is that way.
Yeah, and he conceded.
And you may want to take a hard look at the identitarian political culture in Chicago and ask yourself if that probably isn't true or more likely than not to be true. Yeah.
Like he doesn't check the box because he's not gay or, you know.
Well, this is the identitarian political culture the city has embraced.
Right, I agree.
This is why Vallis is a decided underdog, and this is why, in part, I say the campaign he's running right now may get him to the runoff, but it will not get him to the fifth floor. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, you guys, the problem with, I love Paul because he's calm and measured, Amy, and he's smart and all of that I do. But I, you know, I'm not voting in the city either, but Willie has the fire in the belly. Willie connects with a greater population. That's my problem with Paul. What do you think? I mean, he's dry. His ads aren't so good. Willie's ads on TV are connecting with the people. That thing on Tucker Carlson last night was flipping awesome. I mean, really, don't you think, Dan?
Thanks for the call, Mark. I think he did fine.
I think blow any wind up my skirt. I mean, it was whatever.
I think Willie is real.
Yeah.
I don't think he's positioning. I don't think he's posturing. And from my interactions with Willie, he is a lot shrewder than he may come across because of the way he speaks, as we've talked about. I mean, again, if it was anybody else, or if I should say it this way, if it was somebody who, you know, spoke the King's English, if it was somebody who spoke like Paul Vallis and had built a $50 million business or whatever it is, coming from being a sharecropper in the Jim Crow South, making his way here and then building anybody else that would be getting like the support from the business community. Oh, look at the business success of this guy. But because Willie is from the hood by way of Louisiana, and because he didn't even get a grade school education, in part because he came up when structural institutional racism was a real thing, Jim Crow, he's, you know, dismissed as somebody among the chattering classes who, you know, he doesn't speak proper. So how could he manage the city? How could he run the city? He doesn't present like one of us. So how could he run the city? Which is so funny because these are the same people that are for endlessly prattling on about diversity and inclusion and tolerance and blah, 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 blah. And they're, you know, they're phony intellectuals and smug elitist D-bags, the most of them. Anybody else with Willie's resume and a presentation like a Vallis or somebody, even like a Chewy Garcia or a Roderick Sawyer, would be treated very differently by the media. Her perception among the electorate would be very different than Willie's. And frankly, that sort of attitude that is being directed at Willie is one of the reasons, it's even more reason to like him, more reason I like him, is because I despise the people who look down on him. I despise them. They're terrible. They're terrible human beings. They've done terrible things to this city, and they should be rejected wholesale. And if elevating Willie Wilson rejects those people, then sign me up, which is why I'm a member of Honkies for Willie, Whitey's for Willie. I'm the honky who was a charter member of Whitey's for Willie from 4 years ago. Right. Ziff, Hyde Park.
Woo. Wow.
Yeah. Damn straight.
Man, you just blew me off my seat.
That's what I do.
Wow. So. But you're right. You are absolutely right. I'm not going to give my vote until the very end. I'm going to need my whole minute, guys. You're right about Willie Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a great story. But here's the thing. I benefited from both gentlemen. Willie Wilson, Dr. Wilson gave me $10,000 for my baseball program. Paul Vallis, my brother was dying, and they were going to, public school was going to kick him off the insurance. Paul said, keep him on and help us bury him. And Paul's a good friend of the family. Now, here's how I'm voting. Woolley's a great man. His staff, he picks people that's not good for his staff. That's why they haven't told him to shut up and just show him. That's his staff. He'll be bad with picking administration. But here's where Paul would. Paul would be the Lyndon Baines, not Lyndon Baines, he would be the Gerald Ford for us right now. Paul could bring the police and both communities together. Yep. Paul walks in the black community. We've been knowing Paul for years. So I'm going with Paul. If it's down to the two of them, I will go for Paul because Paul could bring the police and the community together. Paul Vallis, my vote.
Thanks for the call, Ziff. Although I don't know if Paul Vallis is going to embrace that he would be like the Gerald Ford of Chicago.
It's okay to be nerdy.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, part two, oh boy, of the Project Veritas undercover sting. The target, Pfizer's Jordan Tristan Walker, the director of research and development for strategic operations and mRNA scientific planning. So, undercover journalist, James O'Keefe's operation, Project Veritas, befriends Jordan Tristan Walker and has a series of dinners with him where they talk about what Pfizer is doing with respect to their COVID vaccine program. We brought this to you yesterday, but just a little refresher in case you missed it. What is Pfizer doing with their COVID vaccine program? Here's what Jordan Tristan Walker had to say.
What is Pfizer doing, I guess, to optimize, you know, the vaccines now?
Oh, we actually had a meeting about that today, so there's a lot.
Really?
They're doing, I don't know if I should say this. We're exploring, like, you know how the virus keeps mutating?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things we're exploring is, like, why don't we just mutate it ourselves so we can develop new vaccines, right? So we have to do that. If we're going to do that, though, there's a risk of, like, as you could imagine, no one wants to be having a pharma company mutating f***ing viruses.
Yeah.
So we're like, do we want to do this? So that's, like, one of the things we're considering.
Okay.
So, like, the future, like, maybe we can, like, create new versions of the vaccines and things like that.
Okay, so Pfizer ultimately is thinking about mutating COVID?
Well, that is not what we say to the public. No. That's why it was a thought that came up in a meeting, and we were like, why do we not? It was like, we're going to consider that with more discussions.
Okay.
That exact reaction, right? We're like, wait a minute. Like, people won't like that.
Right. Bring the Wuhan Virology Lab in-house there at Pfizer, mutate the virus, create vaccines for the mutations, and you have an endless stream of boosters and revenue.
So Pfizer is doing that.
So probably what they want to do is, like, to try to figure out, to some extent, you know, there's all these new strains of variants that just pop up. Why don't we try to, like, catch them before they pop up in nature, and we can develop a vaccine prophylactic for, like, new variants.
Yeah.
So that's why they're thinking, like, if you do it controlled in the lab, then you say, oh, this is a new epitope. And so then if it comes out later on, like, in the public, we already have a vaccine kind of working on it.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't that, like, the best business model, though? Like, just control nature before nature even happens itself, right?
Yeah, yeah. If it works.
What do you mean if it works?
Because, like, some of the times there were just mutations that pop up, right? And we're not prepared for it, like with Delta or Omicron.
Right.
And things like that. So, who knows? I mean, either way, it's going to be a cash cow. COVID will probably be a cash cow for us for a while going forward.
Like, yeah.
I obviously like it.
Well, I think the whole, you know, I think the whole, like, research of the viruses and mutating it, like, would be the ultimate, like, cash cow.
Yeah, it'd be perfect.
Yeah, it'd be perfect.
He's enjoying himself way too much.
Well, he's on
he
a date.
He loves this.
He thinks he's on a date.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's why, maybe that's why he's a little bit giggly.
Like a schoolgirl.
And if you're listening to this, you think, well, wait, is that the gain of function research that Fauci and Rand Paul spent the last couple of years arguing about? No, no, no. Don't call it gain of function research. It's directed evolution. Mm-hmm. Well, after that was posted the other day, part two is James O'Keefe himself confronting, oh boy. Confronting Jordan Tristan Walker, as is James O'Keefe's wont in these exposés, at a coffee shop in New York City. And suffice it to say that Jordan Tristan Walker from Pfizer was a little bit taken aback.
Oh, really?
Didn't see this one coming.
Hey there. Is this seat taken?
What?
Hi. You work for Pfizer. My question for you is, why does Pfizer want to hide from the public the fact that they're mutating the COVID viruses?
Is this real life? What is happening here?
Why?
What is going on here? This is absurd.
Why does Pfizer want to hide from the public that they're mutating the COVID virus?
Oh, my God.
You're on video. You're on video.
Pfizer
ultimately
is thinking about
mutating the COVID virus.
What is going on here? I need to call the police right now. This is
I don't know what's going on either.
This is ridiculous.
So you're on video. I'm a journalist.
Bro, first of all, I'm literally a liar.
So he's on video.
Whoa.
You're saying we're exploring how the virus keeps mutating.
Yes,
one of the things we're exploring is
right,
why don't we mutate the virus?
I don't know what's happening. But I really need the cops here right now.
So
what is this?
Please do.
Please
do call the police. Please do call the police. Please do.
I can't do this here, guys.
Okay.
You have to leave. No, you can't do this here.
You're going to call the police. He's going to call the police for asking him a question. Please do call the police. Please do. He's on tape here talking about mutating the COVID virus. Can I talk to you outside about this?
Absolutely not. You cannot use my likeness on this. What is your name? Because you f***ed up. You really did. I'm about to sue you. This is absurd.
Please.
You have someone mock me as if they're going on a date to record me? You don't even know my position at this. I was trying to impress a person on a date by lying. I was literally trying.
Okay.
I'm not even a scientist by background. You know
that
I came from a consulting firm that does business. This is absurd.
Please don't touch me.
This is absurd. Please call the cops here.
Please do call the cops. Please do.
Please.
Why would you call the cops if you have nothing to hide?
This is better than the old SNL 60 Minutes spoof with Martin Short as Nathan Thurm when they do remember,
yeah, I remember.
They do the Mike Wallace ambush interview. It's like I'm not being defensive. He's being defensive, right? Why is it always me? It's ever the other guy. Also very concerning to Tristan Walker. As he is losing his mind over now realizing that he has been caught on tape saying things. And I'm lying. I'm
well,
lying. I was just trying to impress a date. Those were some very specific lies.
Those weren't rehearsed. That was,
he goes on to also basically say, like, I'm a complete fraud. I'm not a scientist. I came from Boston Consulting Group. So take a listen.
Can I talk to you, please, about this video?
Okay, so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 white.
Why would you bring race into
this? He's on the phone. There are 5 white people around me. I'm not safe.
We have you on tape talking about mutating the COVID virus.
No one mutates a COVID virus.
Show you the May I show you the video?
No, I want to call the police, but please don't let them leave.
Do we have to leave?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, I couldn't.
No, you cannot just leave.
Are you? Do you want me to leave?
I want the police to come here and see all of you people. Because this
can
is insane.
Can I ask you about this video?
Insane.
Please.
You can tell them about how
please.
I was lying to a press
here,
date.
Just, is it true what you said?
What is this? No. I literally was on a birthday with a guy, and like normal men, you lie to impress a date.
Mutating viruses? Do you not work for Pfizer? Sir, do you not work for Pfizer? Do you work for?
I'm a contractor. What the fuck are you?
Do you currently work for Pfizer? Yes or no? Do you currently work for Pfizer? Yes or no?
What are you talking about here? Please, I want the cops to be here.
So you don't work for Pfizer.
Making it so much worse.
Right, and then they put a screenshot of his LinkedIn page, which shows you know the title that they published with the interview, that he's the director of R&D strategic operations, mRNA scientific planning. Is there on his LinkedIn page too? So if it's a fraud, it's a comprehensive one. And
then
you know,
it's worse.
I'm just a contractor. I don't know what you're talking about. Then he goes the other direction.
If you suspect that mutating COVID virus, is this the way the virus started in Wuhan? Why do you think it's okay for Pfizer to do that?
We were sitting on a date.
He's filming the restaurant owner right now. He's filming her. I don't know why he's filming her.
No, don't.
He goes on to say, I'm just trying to help the public. Why are you doing this to me when I'm just trying to help the public? Wait a second. I thought you said you didn't work for Pfizer and you don't know what anybody's talking about. Now uh-huh. You're saying you're trying to help the public. Do
he's,
what?
He's, oh boy, his back is against the wall and he's making it worse.
He's melting down. Then.
Yeah, you're right. He's having a meltdown and then it gets violent. It gets real bad, Dan.
It does.
This is not good.
But this is after he gets the restaurant, the coffee shop owner to lock O'Keefe and his crew in the restaurant. As they're telling him to leave,
ma'am, you locked
melee,
the door.
Chaos.
Ma'am, we're trying to leave, but you locked us in here.
Call our attorney.
Can you please unlock your door? Let us out.
No, I don't know what's going on. I don't want anyone leaving, but I know what's going on. What are you trying to
kill me? Kidnapping charges.
Can you please unlock your door?
No, don't let them leave.
Can you unlock the door?
I still have pain. Please, no, don't let them out. Don't let them out.
Could you please let us leave, ma'am?
Can't hold them against their will.
We'd like to leave. We'd like to leave. Please unlock the door.
No.
Please unlock the door. Please unlock the door. Please unlock the door. 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 This is remarkable here. Thank you. We're trying to get unlock the door. Unlock the door. Unlock the door. Unlock the door.
It is not. Stop. Let go of me. Now you're hurting me. What is going on here? You cannot just record people like that.
Come on.
It's not okay.
Come on.
It's not okay.
Let's go. Let's go. Come on. Let's go. Let's go. Come on. We're in New York City. This is remarkable.
I mean, this is like a bad Jerry Springer show, or maybe a good Jerry Springer show going on here. I'm surprised
yeah.
I didn't grab a chair and start. Hey, but
break,
they're all fighting
break
each other,
Geraldo
pushing
Rivera's
each other.
Nose. Yeah, right.
Grabbing cameras.
So the cops ultimately do arrive, and one of the and this is after O'Keefe and one of his camera guys has already left when they finally open the door, and the Project Veritas reporter that's left behind just shows them the video of what happened because they were filming it the whole time, and asked the cop, you know. Could Jordan Tristan Walker be arrested for assault? Would you arrest him?
He's charging the guy, charging.
You can't make an arrest at this point if you don't have the victim right here.
Okay. If he was here, you'd arrest that guy?
If he was here, yes.
Oh, then we could just walk away then. Not worry about it.
If that's what you guys want to do, then yes.
The key there is just to say that, I mean, just for, you know, police confirmation after seeing the video of who initiated the contact, and it was Jordan Tristan Walker who takes O'Keefe's iPad, smashes it on the ground, then he's trying to get at the camera, and the camera guy pushes him back off. I mean, it was not that violent, but it was just a melee. It was crazy.
And then he jumps in, when they're taking out, he jumps in front of their car and is stopping police.
He's
out of his mind.
He jumped in front of a car he thought was their car.
Right.
It wasn't.
And it wasn't. But, I mean, he almost got hit by the car because he's an idiot. He's just so desperate. He's like a cat clawing out of a box.
You can't do this. You can't. Oh, really? Have you? Let me introduce you to Pam Zekman and Dave Savini and Mike Wallace and all the journalists of the left who used to love to do the ambush interviews, love to do the undercover work. But and now, you know, and of course, that was great journalism. But now when James O'Keefe does it, oh, my gosh. You know, you can't do this. It's a violation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, know what state you live in. Know what the privacy rules are. It's a two-party consent state, so they could do what they did was legal.
And then Jordan Tristan Walker concluded.
You seem defensive.
I'm not being defensive. You're the one who's being defensive. Why is it always the other person who's being defensive? Have you ever asked yourself that? Why don't you ask yourself that?
This is a great question. And, it's too bad there wasn't a laugh track that James O'Keefe put into the part two video, because it would be appropriate. Jordan Tristan Walker losing his mind. So there, by the way, just to reset, what you heard, both in terms of what he had to say on the merits during what he thought was a date, and then the reaction when he's confronted with what he said, that comes to you just one more time, just to make sure everybody gets it. From the Director of Research and Development for Strategic Operations and mRNA Scientific Planning. Who wants to line up for their booster? Matt, South Bend.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking my call. Statement about the new project, Warped Greed, and just amazing. I got the shot. I was supporting my family, I thought, and then just this getting into the mix of it is just totally disgusting for me. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Verlon, Southside.
Are you sure this wasn't an episode of Cheaters?
It's close.
James O'Keefe is more man than me to go on a date undercover.
Somebody else did. Somebody else did.
Oh, okay.
But he was at the restaurant, and then they waited to come
and,
up to him.
And the guy that he thought he was on a date with was part of O'Keefe's crew, because he pointed him out. He says, I thought I was on a date with that guy, and he's all, you know. And, you know, and so, hey, look, this is the only people say, well, I feel bad for that guy. And
But
this is the only way you get any honesty.
Yeah.
Right? If Pfizer and these people were more forthright, then the sort of guerrilla journalism that James O'Keefe does would not be necessary, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for Lon. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
One more note on Jordan Tristan Walker.
Yeah. What? Did he lose his job over this?
Not yet that we know of. But there's a lot of people, of course, because it's O'Keefe, saying, oh, this is a hoax and so on and so forth. Really. Graduated Yale in 2013.
Of course he did.
Doctor of Medicine from Southwestern Medical School. Also, O'Keefe tweeted out, we have obtained internal documents verifying Walker as Pfizer's Director of Research and Development for Strategic Operations and mRNA. His supervisor reports to Mikhail Dolsten, who reports to Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer. Mm. So a lot of detail here. So if it's a hoax, then it's one he's perpetrated on Pfizer and LinkedIn and everywhere else, too. Not a hoax. Doesn't seem to be a hoax. A lot of evidence to suggest the contrary. So likely than not that it is very real, and you should be exceedingly frightened about who's in charge of helping us combat infectious diseases.
And when he brought race into it, too, like, there's five white people here. Help me.
Somebody asked, somebody texted, how did he not recognize, or know who James O'Keefe was? Because he's been spending all his time on Grindr, obviously.
Stop. All right, real quick, before you go to break, a big, big shout out and happy birthday to one of our avid listeners, very dear friend of the family, Marlon. It's his birthday today. We want you to have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening. And Marlon, you should call in sometime. You know what I mean, on your way to work. So we.
How old is Marlon?
I don't know. You know what? I don't ask. Once we get to a certain age, Dan, we don't ask anymore. You should indeed. Know that, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Five Memphis police officers have been charged with the murder of Tyree Nichols. This is a traffic stop that went bad, and the body cam, dash cam video, whatever video they have, is going to be released this evening. And you know, preparation and commentary in advance of preparation for that release is already at fever pitch, of course, because Tyree Nichols is a black man, was a black man. You know, as the story goes, as reported, is that he was coming back from, he's a 29-year-old, he was a 29-year-old guy, a FedEx worker. He was an avid skateboarder. He was returning home from a suburban park where he had taken photos of the sunset, according to family attorneys. On the way home, he stopped for reckless driving, according to Memphis police. Officers approached Nichols to arrest him. A confrontation occurred. He fled. Second confrontation occurred at some point before Nichols was ultimately arrested. Following the arrest, Nichols complained of having a shortness of breath, at which time an ambulance was called. He was taken to the hospital in critical condition, and 3 days later, he succumbed to his injuries.
Did you see the pictures of him in the hospital? I mean, it was a beatdown for 3 minutes straight. And his mom was interviewed yesterday because she saw the video.
Have you seen the video?
It's not out yet. I haven't seen it.
Right.
The mom. I'm just quoting the mom. And she lasted a minute, and then she couldn't watch it anymore. And they're saying it's going to be worse than Rodney King, you know, the video that you saw of Rodney King beating, and to prepare ourselves. And now they're preparing Memphis because they think, excuse me, the protesters are going to burn down Memphis. But are they? I mean, they're five black officers. They've all been fired for a reason.
Well, that's a key point. Isn't
and that's
it?
The thing. It's now. Well, I want to see what's going to happen.
The five officers charged are black, all of them.
Yep, they're black. So what's going to happen? And the mom's out, you know, making the rounds on media or on cable TV stations, saying, "Please protest peacefully, please, please." But the pictures—I couldn't even look at the pictures of him in the hospital. Ugh. I mean, you can really barely recognize his face.
The grand jury handed down indictments, second-degree murder, aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, official misconduct, and official oppression against all five former Memphis police officers. By the way, Memphis, one of the more violent cities in America, one of the highest, like right behind New Orleans, one of the highest murder per capita rates in the country. So we'll see what the video shows. But, of course, this incident provides the occasion for race-hustling New York Times columnists like Charles Blow to opine about the lack of allyship from, particularly from you honkies that were out there protesting in the summer of 2020, the summer of love and lockdowns, you remember, and, you know, calling for defunding the police. What happened to that, Charles Blow?
This is exactly what happens when we treat police misconduct and reform as a seasonal fad, when we treat it as if it was a part of a summer of protests and we moved on because crime rose or because politicians got skittish and no one really wanted to worry about anymore about police reform. They wanted to move on to other issues, try to avoid the appellation that they were woke or that they were for defund the police. Now we are now stuck in a situation where we sit around worrying about and focusing on the angry reaction to violence rather than the police violence that precipitates the angry reaction. That is perverse. We are on television now because it is possible that people will be very upset when they see this video. We don't back up and say, why did we give up on the possibility of real reform in the first place that would have possibly changed some of these patterns in the first place? It is not an anomaly that this happens out of a routine traffic stop. When you think back of all the high-profile police killings, particularly of Black men and women in this country, they start as routine traffic stops. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is a profit imperative that police departments have, rather than them politicians being brave enough to raise taxes, they turn to police departments to help them to make money through fines and summonses. That becomes the, you know, that profit imperative is at the root of a lot of what we're seeing. And then eventually, out of all of those stops, in a few of them, something goes tragically wrong. And we start to say, well, let's look at these officers. Let's look at this particular person. How did they act in particular, rather than systemically, that there is a problem here that we are still not dealing with.
Mm-hmm. He talks around and round and round about it. A key paradox presented by Charles Blow there. Got to listen closely. The situation, the Tyre Nichols case, is not anomalous. That's what he said. Okay. Then at the end of that clip, he says what? In a few of the cases. That is the definition of anomalous. A few of the cases, something like what happened in Memphis, happens. But it's not anomalous, it's systemic. So we just don't do traffic stops. Well, we've gotten away from that in Chicago and obviously a lot of other big cities because number one, traffic stops are dangerous. Number three, they become onerous with the paperwork in places like Chicago, so it's not worth it. And so is that what you want to do? Just have, I mean, look, hey, as somebody who's gotten more than my fair share of moving violations over the years, you don't want to stop me for speeding? Great. Fine by me. But is that where you want to go? That's what you think will cure the situation of anomalous police stops that end in violence and even more anomalous that end in death? Just don't enforce any traffic laws. Police don't stop any vehicles for any reason. Then there won't be any confrontation. That seems to be what Charles Blow is arguing. He continued.
But the moment that they could get back to regular life, they also got back to regular priorities. And that did not include the defense of these Black and brown bodies that were laying in the streets because of police violence. And that is a question that America has to ask itself. Where was your commitment? People talk so much about allyship. In fact, the majority of people out marching during the summer protests were not even Black or Hispanic. They were white people. And then all of that somehow dissipates because you say that crime goes up in post-COVID because of the trauma of COVID. And all of a sudden, then now we can't talk about it. So these other lives, you know, the number of police killings of Black people, of American citizens, did not go down post-2020. It keeps going up, actually. But now we can't talk about it. Those bodies become collateral damage to the fact that you are now scared about a rising crime. The criminal cannot be an excuse for you not to pay attention to people who are innocent and who are killed.
Totally straw dog argument. Nobody is saying that the criminal is an excuse for anybody's rights being violated by police. Nobody's saying that. Nobody supports that. It's a ridiculous proposition, but these are the false arguments that are presented by hustlers like Charles Blow. And where did all the honkies go, Charles? They went back to Naperville. You know, they had done their virtue signaling. They put their pee hats on, the women too. And they you know, marched in the streets, defund police, Black Lives Matter, blah, blah, we love Marxism, so on and so forth. And then they went home. They had contributed what they felt they needed to contribute to assuage their guilt. And so then that's over. Who'd you think they were? Would you think they were Black Panthers? Uh-huh. How anomalous is it? We had this conversation with Raphael Manguel from the Manhattan Institute at the end of the show yesterday. And he just presented the data that punctures the arguments of these hustlers like Charles Blow.
The typical person coming out of a state prison has between 10 and 12 prior arrests, between 5 and 6 prior convictions. These are not people who have been denied second chances. Right? If you look at the quote-unquote police violence issue, what you find is that, you know, police make about 10 million arrests a year. They fire their weapons about 3,000 times a year. They use physical force of any kind in maybe 2% of those arrests that are affected. And when they do, there's almost never an injury. This is not the story that you get when you turn on the news, when you, you know, walk into a university classroom. And that's really what has to change.
Yeah, and when you listen to Charles Bloviating on MSNBC, like you just heard.
Well, what message is probably going to get lost on all of this is if police pull you over, just comply. I mean, it wouldn't have led to this, and I know the video, I haven't seen it, you know, but and it's probably going to be disgusting. Like they're, you know, they're telling us it's going to be like that. But just, again, don't resist arrest.
Right.
It happened in George Floyd. It happened and it happens everywhere. Every single time, the thing that starts out with is resisting arrest, and then it leads to someone's death. And the two of the five officers, they've lawyered up and they said, no, this is not what you think it is, and more details are going to come out.
Even when there is a resist arrest incident, it very rarely leads to death.
True. Very rare. Very rare. Yes.
Yeah. And so and again, one unnecessary death is one too many. I concede the point. But what Charles Blow is presenting is without foundation.
Yeah.
It is. And instead of trying to provide some context and intelligence to have a measured conversation about this, he just comes out with the same incendiary tropes we've been hearing for years and years and years. The other part of that, too, which you heard from Raphael Manguel. So the problem is not COVID trauma,
no,
which led to a spike in crime. The problem is big city mayors and prosecutors who don't want to punish and imprison habitual violent offenders. Yeah. That's the problem.
And big city mayors who had stand down orders and let people take whatever they wanted from all the fancy stores on Michigan Avenue and Oak Street, whatever they wanted. Pull up that U-Haul. Come on.
That is an illustration of their ideology.
Right.
John in Bridgeport, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
All right, Dan and Amy, I got one for you. It really makes me sad and mad. Amy, I'll let you do the follow-up. Really bother with the media with this one, but this past Sunday, 3 college students, 2 of whom from IIT and 1 from Governor State, needed some computer supplies, and their app took them to 84th and just off the Dan Ryan there.
Oh, boy.
They took the bus down there. Right when they got off the bus, they were greeted by a car full of thugs with guns. They ordered them to get on the parking lot ground. As they searched them, went through them, took their belongings, and then as they were face down, felt the need, like in St. Valentine's Day Massacre, to just execute them right there with several rounds of bullets, killing 2, 1 still surviving, but nothing said on the media about this. Nothing said anywhere about this.
Never. I have not heard a word about this story.
And here you go. And the video is there in the parking lot, too, if they're able to release it. So,
all right, I'll contact CPD.
By all means. And it's horrible, because whether you have college students or whether you have people you know in college, they go to stuff like this all the time, and just to get massacred like this is unbelievable.
And you said this happened last weekend?
This past Sunday. Okay. This past Sunday.
I will text.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Thanks for the call, John. How bad is it in big cities? Well, we've told you the data. It probably bears repeating. It's so stunning. Averaging about 100 carjackings a day, car thefts and slash carjackings a day. This month, more than 2,200 car thefts in Chicago. Oh, no. This month.
It's so bad that they had a
I thought when the barometric pressure goes down that crime goes down.
It did in the past, Dan.
Up 156% year over year.
156. And it's so bad if you own a Kia or a Hyundai that they're handing out. Remember the club? We're going old school now. Do you remember that, Dan, that you put on your steering wheel? They're giving those away at a community meeting yesterday. Like, come on, if you own one of these cars, you can just take it.
And no one's immune, just like Trevor Siemian found out when his car was stolen from the Beverly Country Club parking lot last summer. Eagles safety, Philadelphia Eagles safety. I hope he can get to the NFC Championship game on time. C.J. Gardner-Johnson got his car stolen after their win against San Francisco.
Exactly who took my car.
There you go.
Thank you.
I heard that. Yep. Yeah, if you want me to, I can send these clips.
Yeah, it's good. I know exactly who stole my bro. Yeah, don't worry, buddy. We got y'all on camera. Wow.
Hey, where was that angle?
That's how y'all getting down? In Philly, y'all still a nigga after a win?
Y'all steal my blank after a win? Yeah. Yeah, that's how they're getting down in Philly.
Yeah.
Larry Krasner, the Kim Fox double in Philly. Jim Kinney, the honky version of Lori Lightfoot in Philly. Same deal. Same deal in all these big cities, something Charles Blow and these race hustlers don't want to address. Oh, and by the way, what's happening in Illinois? Well, yesterday, our duly elected Attorney General, Kwame Raoul, filed a brief with the Supreme Court arguing for the Supreme Court to uphold the constitutionality of the Safety Act. So,
God. Their focus
so
is in
what's
the wrong
going on in Chicago can make its way to the suburbs. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez represents the Southwest Side neighborhoods, West Inglewood, Brighton Park, Back of the Yards, Gage Park. He was a candidate for mayor. He dropped out of the race, and he endorsed Willie Wilson for mayor. And he joins us now. Alderman Lopez, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning to you both.
To talk a little bit about your process. We talked to you when you were considering running for mayor. You announced, then you decided not to go forward. Just the decision you made about your own candidacy, and then lead us to your decision to endorse Willie Wilson from the remaining field.
When I was in the race originally, I ran. I was the first one to announce, and when I left, there were nearly a dozen candidates in the race, all trying to replace Lori Lightfoot. And what I had thought being created with so many individuals in the race was a path for victory for Lori Lightfoot. And I think you, I, and all of your listeners can agree that is the absolute last thing Chicago needs, a second term with Lori Lightfoot. The only way to ensure her defeat was to narrow down the field and to coalesce behind one of her stronger opponents. And in my opinion, that is Dr. Willie Wilson. He and I have worked together over the years, not just in this election season, but in every season for the past few years, trying to bring jobs to the community, trying to use the city's $1.2 billion water and sewer main replacement program as a jobs program to put people to work all across Chicago, as well as to bring important PPE and materials to our first responders and essential workers. We've been building a working relationship for years, and I felt that he would be the best choice for me and my ward, having a mayor who not only answers my call, but has proven himself to work with our communities. And I endorsed him, and I continue to push for his victory, because we need a man who not only understands how to work with people, to work with different communities, to go outside of their respective bases, but to build coalitions, but is also unafraid to stand up to the criminal element in our city. And that is something that he has espoused famously or notoriously, even as recently as last week. But he does this from a place of truth, because this is where his heart is. Having been a victim and seeing his own son killed, he knows the pain that people go through. And we often lose sight of the numbers of the violence, that there are families and victims associated with each one of them. And Doc will speak for all of them and for all of us.
What if he doesn't make the runoff? Are you going to be supporting another candidate then? And where do you draw the line? I know you're not going to be backing Mayor Lightfoot, but what about a Chewy Garcia?
I'm familiar with Chewy, and he's an empty suit.
Yep.
and that's as polite as I can say it. Look, 30 years in government, he has 5 different pensions coming his direction, and not a single achievement that anybody can point to. Little Village, which is his home base, is no better for his presence. It's not safer, so I don't care what he says about building a safer community, because it's a lie. All he is an opportunist, and Chicago needs more than an opportunist mayor.
You had some infamous contretemps with Lightfoot about public safety. She even swore at you. She was so upset.
Yes.
And so it seems to me, Amos, and when you announced you public safety was central, backing the police, and you've been one of the more outspoken aldermen in terms of backing the police and the need for police to do police work and to have civilian support,
yes,
so that we get habitual violent offenders off the streets and so on and so forth. So it seems to us, we were having this conversation earlier, there's two candidates who agree with you about that. Willie Wilson is one and Paul Vallis is the other. So the choice between Willie Wilson and Lori Lightfoot's obvious. The choice between Paul Vallis and Willie Wilson is a little less obvious to a lot of people. How did you make the decision between those two?
You know, I've spoken with Paul on a couple of occasions, and Paul is eminently qualified because he's very knowledgeable. But at the end of the day, I need to go with someone who, one, I know I can work with, and two, that I know I have worked with. And Dr. Wilson and I, as I said earlier, have worked together when there was no name on a ballot, when there was no ballot to choose from. And that matters to me. In any political arena, you have a choice of going with what people promise or what people have done. And I can speak from personal experience and know that Dr. Wilson has done for my ward, my police districts, my communities, long before there was an election to even discuss, when we were trying to help everyone get through the pandemic, get through Lori Lightfoot's excessive shutdown of Chicago. We were all trying to work our way through it to protect our workers, protect our first responders, protect our police officers. And Dr. Wilson was there with me in that fight, and that has not been lost on me.
What do you think he needs to do, though, to push himself, you know, over the finish line to get to the runoff? I mean, we see signs everywhere, every billboard in my neighborhood. If it's empty, it's got a Willie Wilson picture of him on it. But what recommendations do you have for him?
What I believe, and I know Dan mentioned on his Twitter Willie's performance last night on Tucker, which I was very pleased with. You know, he has to connect with the thousands of people who are forgotten in the city of Chicago, and those are the families and victims of Chicago's violence. He himself is part of that group. And sadly, it's a growing demographic in the city that nobody wants to talk about, and almost nobody in the mayor's race can relate to. If we are going to have him as our mayor. He has to foster that emotional connection. And I think he has to narrow the band a little bit, in my opinion, on some of the policy issues, which I've been helping him with, as a number of other people have as well. But we need a leader who is willing to listen to all ideas. And Dr. Wilson readily admits he doesn't know everything about what's going on, but that he's willing to listen and willing to bring in the best and the brightest to make it happen. And that is something that we clearly have never seen from this administration. And I don't think we're going to see from a number of the candidates in this race who are puppets of somebody else. Dr. Wilson is willing to open the door, put more seats at the table, and he needs to get that message out, because I think that is the only way that you're going to fix a lot of these monumental problems that Lori Lightfoot is leading the next administration. She has a budget that's grossly out of balance, only functional now because of Joe Biden's federal dollars that cover up all of the debt and budget gaps that she's put in. You still have a 45 years left of her 48 years of mandatory cost of living tax increases that are still on the books. And you have a police department as well as an entire city workforce that doesn't want to be here anymore because of the way they've been treated by this administration.
Well, I'll tell you, but this is all going to get solved when people gobble up those Chicago social bonds.
That's going to save us. Yeah.
I mean, I'm liquidating everything I have to get in on that action. Yeah.
Which saves Chicago all of $80,000 in a $16 billion budget.
$80,000 already? Wow, that's great.
Oh, I was expecting so much more.
We just have,
rolling right now.
We just have a few tens of billions to go. The whole system thing, Willie admits he doesn't know, how everything works and so forth. Well, the flip side of that argument is we've had mayors for the last half century that know the system. They know the system. That person's going to be a steady hand because they know the system. That person knows how to keep people safe because she's a former federal prosecutor in the case of Lori Lightfoot. Well, the people that know the system, hey, take a look around. What does the system produce from all these people in leadership that know the system?
We need a mayor who is focused on outcomes, not the system. And we've heard that time and time again, particularly from conservative people who say you have to support outcomes, not systems, whether it's in education, whether it's in city services, you name it. And I think Dr. Wilson will bring that same mindset to the city of Chicago, because clearly, if you're just here to protect the status quo, if you're not willing to completely shake things up to bring in some new ideas, if you're trying to make an omelet, you're going to wind up with a hard-boiled egg instead. And we don't need any more boiled eggs in the city of Chicago.
Something interesting about this relationship you have with Willie Wilson, I absolutely loathe the racial politics of the city, not because I don't want people to celebrate their heritage and the great diversity of the city. That's all fine. That's all well and good. I'm talking about the racial politics, emphasis on politics, and say, well, what's the big deal? Ray is a Latino and Willie's black, but we've seen Latinos and blacks come together before. Yeah, but not exactly. They come together. They rally around the flag based on identity to protect the system, to distribute the spoils of war. It seems to me this may be an opportunity for a black politician and a Latino politician to come together to change the system in a way that will serve blacks and Latinos and everybody else, but it's not so driven by race identity.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because identity politics is what's ruining this country and has ruined this city. And we see it even in our remapping, where you had to put people in little boxes simply because they were black, white, Latino, or Asian, as opposed to creating districts that put everyone together and force everyone to work together for the common good. Dr. Wilson and I, even when we were opponents, were friendly, cordial, because we are friends and cordial to each other, just personally. And there's a genuineness to that. The fact that so many people, when I dropped out, automatically assumed that I was going to go with Chewy because we have the same brown card is ridiculous, because we are nothing alike. I don't support criminals. He does. I have accomplishments. He doesn't. And that's not how I am not required to automatically go with the man with the mustache simply because we both have about the same melatonin in our skin. That's not how politics should work. And I think that, to your point, Dan, this shows that you can be aligned by ideas and goals as opposed to just simply the color of your skin, which that's what Dr. Martin Luther King wanted. That's what Harold Washington proved. And if you're really serious about that, then this is an opportunity for I to show Chicago that you don't have to just be set in the tracks other people have made for you, that you can't step out of the rut and do something different if you want something different.
So, Alderman, I want to know if you're still licking your wounds this morning, because yesterday Governor Pritzker put out a list of aldermen that he's supporting for reelection, and guess what? You're not on the list. Why are you off the list, Mr. Lopez?
You know, I didn't know that the governor was making endorsements, and when I look at some of the names that are on that list, it's not a crowd that I associate with anyway. But what I think is very telling to me, Amy, is that if you look at who's not on the list, all of your common sense aldermen have been skipped.
Like who? All Give of us those names.
I mean, like Alderman Spezzato, Alderman Napolitano, Alderman Tabarez, I believe Alderman O'Shea, all of us who believe in both law and order, strengthening our economies by, you know, making it easier to do business and delivering city services, all were skipped.
Yeah.
All of the ones who support bail reform, all of the ones who are criminal enablers, all of the ones who are yes men bobbleheads, basically, got an endorsement. And I think, you know, the governor has a right to choose who he wants to work with in city council. But I think I heard him in a message saying yesterday that he wasn't going to endorse anyone in the mayor's race because he wants to work with everyone. Well, it's hard to work with everyone when you start picking winners and losers, and especially when you're going to have a number of winners who you left out.
Did he refrain from endorsing Kim Fox over Bob Conway in the primary for a Cook County State's attorney a couple years ago because he wanted to work with everybody? I don't remember. I think he endorsed Kim Fox. In fact, I know he did. So it's interesting
So did Lori Lightfoot.
Right. So that's the posture now, though, by Pritzker, because it was useful because he was playing racial politics with his endorsement of Kim Fox in advance of his reelection. But now, and since he and Lori Lightfoot are not necessarily bosom buddies, he's going to play the, I want to work with anybody and everybody. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if Vallis or Wilson is in the runoff if he chooses to make an endorsement after the fact. Yeah. So that group of common sense aldermen you spoke of, yourself included, what can you guys do, and what is your individual reaction to that OIG report on the Chicago Public Schools that found an unbelievable number of incidents, credible incidents of sexual abuse of students, and potentially
403.
Yeah, and potentially a multi-billion-dollar fraud committed by Chicago Public Schools with respect to their average daily attendance?
Well, I definitely believe that the city council needs to get involved. Our committee on ethics needs to be reviewing and bringing our partners over there from CPS to come in and testify before us as to what's going on, what they're doing to keep children safe, to keep taxpayer dollars safe. Because it's absolutely abhorrent that in 2022, last year, that over there were 1,800 reports to the Inspector General regarding sexual allegations with students and staff, of which 400 proceeded. But the fact that we nearly hit 2,000 complaints is mind-boggling. The fact that they are underreporting in order to get higher funding. It's criminal. And we know that the mayor's not going to bring this forward. She's not going to bring in the light on what on Pedro's doing over there. But we need to. And as far as the common sense folks go, like myself, you know, we've seen in New York, where they've created their own caucus because you have to have somebody who knows and appreciates both sides of the coin of government and you can work with, and I think we may actually be forming down the road a caucus of our own to push back against some of the madness that we see from the Red Rose Brigade and others in city council who are keeping government out of balance for the average working person.
He is 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez. Alderman Lopez, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Chris Busker, friend of the show, publisher of American Greatness, amgreatness.com, has a piece over at Compact, How Republicans Sold Out America, talking about where Republicans have been over the last, well, the 30 years preceding Trump and where they are today as the cohort that was largely in charge of the party pre-Trump is at odds with some of the more populist leadership of the party at present, including Trump. He writes that by the 1970s, conservative ideologues had come to advocate market solutions for just about everything. Some of those solutions made sense, but other policies proved disastrous, including free trade and financialization that led to the breakdown of the middle class, the hollowing out of the American interior, an epidemic of deaths of despair. To reverse these trends, he argues, Republicans must challenge free market orthodoxy. And he gives a couple of examples of what he's talking about in terms of his view on what constituted disastrous policies like the Glass-Steagall Act, which allowed commercial banks to own investment banks and insurance companies and engage in proprietary trading. It was supposed to let banks compete with large foreign banks, but what he would argue, and many others, is that it actually created a too-big-to-fail environment that we all remember in the run-up to the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. From the 1980s until 2016, Republicans sought to make U.S. companies more competitive with foreign companies. The problem was it was never possible to drive low wages, which drive wages low enough to compete with Chinese labor, writes Buskirk. And this is where the transformation happened, he argues, where the Democrat Party became the party of the coasts, the big cities, the very wealthy, the large corporate interests, including big tech. And he reminds us that pre-Trump, it wasn't until back in the 50s when Dwight D. Eisenhower ran for president on raising the minimum wage, expanding Social Security and unemployment insurance, that a Republican presidential candidate was talking about the desirability of rising wages for the middle-income American. And this leads him back to Angelo Codevilla and where the divide is at present. And this has been argued by scholars like one of my favorites, Joel Kotkin, the author of The New Feudalism. He talks about the clerisy versus the yeomanry. He, Buskirk, invokes Angelo Codevilla, who's credited with popularizing, if not coining, the term ruling class, the recently departed academic Codevilla, where you really break it down into a country class versus ruling class. That was Codevilla's formulation, the ruling class versus the country class. Buskirk writes, the more important divide in America today is one between those who've captured a disproportionate share of wealth, power, and status and everyone else. The tension between the ruling class and the country class is profound, but often obscured by ruling class factional conflicts for which the country class is dragooned into action as unwitting foot soldiers who lose no matter which faction wins. And this is part of the argument that Trump made when he ran for president in 2016, wasn't it? Where you had two terms of a Republican president, two terms of a Democrat president, and 16 years of stagnant wages, which in part gave rise to a populist like Trump. So is that the right formulation for the Republican Party? Are those criticisms of free market solutions to things like American competitiveness and a robust middle class that leaves more to their kids than their parents left for them, sort of the generational intergenerational compact? It's a complicated question, and one that brings forth passions from both schools of thought. To get reaction to the argument, pleased to be joined again by Don Boudreau. He's an American economist, author, professor, and co-director of the Program on the American Economy and Globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. You can also get his musings at cafehayek.com, which is a good blog. Don, thanks for joining us. What's that?
Said you named your dog after it.
I named my dog after Frederick von Hayek, not Cafe Hayek. But yeah, close enough. Don Boudreau, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. I loved your dog's name.
Yeah, It was tough. It came down to Friedman versus Hayek, and I just thought Friedman doesn't necessarily invoke Milton, and so yeah.
That
anyway,
I had
digress.
A stereo once named Adam Smith. So
okay, both the first name and last name. Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
I could have done that. Yeah. I could have done Milton Friedman, but it's just like get Milton Friedman, come here, Milton Friedman. I don't know. It just that would sound
weird.
Your
little Milty.
We just called him Adam.
Yeah, it sounds weird anyway. In the park, you know. So, Don, what about Chris Buskirk's argument about things like Glass-Steagall and how that served to the detriment of middle-income families in America rather than the promise that those sorts of ostensibly free-market solutions would lead to more prosperity across income quintiles?
I wish people like that on the right and the left would actually look at the facts, which are not that difficult to acquire. There's a lot wrong in this country, but it is simply untrue, just patently untrue, that American wages have stagnated, that income, mobility across income groups has diminished. It's simply untrue that the middle class has been hollowed out. It's simply untrue that we're deindustrializing. There's no evidence for this for these propositions, and all the evidence points against it. I recommend to your readers who doubt me. There's a wonderful little book. It came out 3 years ago, early 2020, right before COVID, by the economist Michael Strain, who is certainly no libertarian ideologue. He's a very competent, empirically oriented economist at the American Enterprise Institute. It's called The American Middle Class. I think it's called The American Middle Class is Not Dead, but Populism Could Kill It. And he's got reams and reams of easily accessible data with all the sources in there that show that real wages have been rising during this time period. Fringe benefits have been rising. Income mobility is perfectly healthy. Industrialization continues apace. We Americans continue to produce a lot of things. So these people, they just get their facts wrong. They keep repeating the same fallacies, and the fallacies are so ingrained in the popular narrative that they've taken on a life of their own. Once you look at the facts, the whole story collapses. Now, it is true. It is true. There are a lot of problems with the country. This distinction that you mentioned that Joel Kotkin identifies, I think that's real. We do have a divide between these arrogant intellectual elites and ordinary people. But that divide is largely driven now, or driven to a large degree now, by this very myth. We have people on the right and the left saying to ordinary Americans, look, you don't realize you've stagnated. And it's because of free trade, it's because of tax cuts, it's because of deregulation. And so we have to reject all those policies and return to the glorious days of the 1960s and 70s. And that gives these elites more power. Far from taking power from elites, far from giving power to ordinary men and women, the very policies that these people propose would actually genuinely take more power, economic and political power, from ordinary people. So I just wish they would get their facts straight. If you get your facts straight, the whole story again utterly collapses.
But see, here's the problem, one of the problems is, so what do you say, give you a couple examples from Illinois, because I think they represent certainly the Rust Belt, but what's going on in the country generally, and I expect a Schumpeterian response from you, but we'll see. Rockford, Illinois, used to have a thriving manufacturing sector. It used to be a real manufacturing hub for a mid-sized city. Manufacturing pulled out of Rockford, and that community has not recovered since that started occurring in the 80s. Galesburg, another even smaller community. You know, a big employer like Maytag pulls out, and that community never recovers. And a lot of people over the course of the last 25 years leading into the Trump election saw these companies pulling out, saw these companies offshoring at least some of their operations, and said, we're losing our jobs, we're losing our livelihoods, we're losing our community. And what I see is these companies allied with the government getting benefits for offshoring economic opportunities that would are more appropriate for Americans, and American politicians should be looking out for Americans.
So a couple of things. The overall health of an economy cannot be judged by what happens to a particular location. Now, I know that sounds kind of harsh. It may be that Rockford is more stagnant now than it was 40 years ago. But if you look at, and these are the only, these I submit are the relevant statistics. If you look at the overall performance of ordinary American workers, what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls non-supervisory and production workers, you know, hard hat workers, you know, production line workers, non-supervisors. Across America, their wages are rising and their economic opportunities have been increasing. Again, I'm talking about pre-COVID. COVID's messed a bunch of things up. And so the people once in Rockford are now somewhere else earning higher wages to the extent that Rockford has, in fact, perhaps lost population. Farming communities 100 years ago, 120 years ago, lost population. This happens. This is inevitable in any kind of dynamic economy, which you have economic growth. Economic growth changes the location of particular activities. It changes the kinds of activities that are dominant, both in the country as a whole and in particular locations. If we try to prevent change, this now comes to the Schumpeterian part of my answer that you rightly anticipated. If you try to prevent each person from losing a job or each community from changing the tenor and type of its economic activities, then you will doom that economy to stagnation, and everybody will be economically worse off over time. But again, when we look at the overall statistics, we find no evidence that ordinary Americans are suffering. If the people in Rockford, for example, were not able to find jobs in Rockford, of course, it would just be one example of many Rust Belt locations. Presumably, these people would be out there somewhere in the unemployment ranks. They would be driving wages lower when they do get jobs. We don't see any evidence of that, Dan. And one other smaller point, unfortunately, I think this point is swamped by the larger dynamism of the American economy. There are, you know, different states, of course, do have different policies, some better than others. Illinois is not known for its recent friendliness toward investors and entrepreneurs. Right.
You don't say.
And whereas South Carolina and Florida and Texas are. And so it wouldn't be surprising if, as the relative attractiveness of doing business in, say, South Carolina rises relative to that of doing business in Ohio and Illinois, for example, that you would find some communities in Illinois suffering job and business and population loss to these places that are more friendly to commerce.
One other challenge to the free market argument, it seems to me, is the rule of law. You know, markets depend on laws to enforce property rights. And so I think what a lot of people see as well as Republicans and Democrats over the last 35 years who didn't enforce the rule of law in this perhaps as the most pronounced example, border security. And so if you are creating an artificial market with respect to labor, for example, by not enforcing border security, not enforcing the border, and then you're providing benefits for people who arguably under the law wouldn't be entitled to those benefits, like even being in this country, then why should I have confidence that you're going to represent my interests when you won't enforce the law that's supposed to protect them?
One of the great enduring, troubling, and troublemaking fallacies that has been on the loose for quite some time is the equation of Republicans with free marketeers. A handful of them are, but the typical Republican is a politician.
Yeah.
I would say at the margin, generally a little bit more sensible than the typical Democrat these days, but not much more so often the case. But the fact that Republicans pursue various policies, domestic and international, should not be interpreted. Those policies should not be assumed to be pro-free market. Republicans play politics, and politicians, it's just part of what they do, unfortunately. They dispense special privileges. They appease special interest groups at the expense of the larger population. They violate, in other words, the rule of law frequently. It's what they do. And so I agree with you. The Republicans are not very good they're not very principled at sticking to the rule of law. They're very good at talking about it. The Democrats don't at least have given up the pretense of pretending that they favor the rule of law. The Republicans are a little bit more hypocritical, I think, now. They're both Republicans and Democrats, with few exceptions on both sides, violate the rule of law. And you're exactly right. To the extent that the rule of law is violated, then the basis for a thriving market economy is threatened. It's a cancer on that. The market can take a lot of abuse, but it can't take an unlimited amount of abuse before it starts collapsing. So there's a lot of problems on both sides that are accurately described as violations of the rule of law. I agree with that.
He is Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And again, you can also check him out at cafehayek.com, his writings at least. Don Boudreau, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Amy, we talked quite a bit about it earlier in the week. After Nick Clegg, the global public affairs president of Meta, appeared with our friend Brett Baer to talk about the reinstatement of Donald Trump on Facebook and Instagram. And Clegg was asked by Baer about the Facebook files, if you will. Unfortunately, there are not enough of them disclosed because Elon Musk is not running Facebook. But the Facebook content moderation approach, number one, and then connected to collaborating with the government to do the government's bidding and the bidding of various government agencies the way it's been documented Twitter did. And this is what Nick Clegg said. Baer specifically asked him about the Hunter Biden story, as well as discussion of all things COVID on the Meta platform, Facebook. And this Clegg didn't tackle COVID, but he did tackle the Hunter Biden story. And you can extrapolate from his answer on the Hunter Biden story what he would say about their moderation of COVID debates.
Biden story, other platforms, I think it was Twitter, sort of just deleted the story altogether. We didn't. You could still find the story. Millions of people did. But for 7 days, the prominence of the story was less for those 7 days. It's just part of the way our systems work to allow our fact checkers. We have a network of independent fact checkers to look at the story if they wanted to. They didn't, and after 7 days, that what's called in the jargon that temporary demotion was taken off. So we didn't remove it. People could find it. Many people saw it on Facebook. We were simply following the rules by which our systems currently operate.
Of course. Yeah, and the independent fact checkers, and who could question the integrity of the independent fact checkers, those networks, just had to demote it for 7 days, to get through the election, and then people could find it. Yeah. For more on this, please be joined by Robbie Suave. He's the senior editor of senior editor at Reason, Reason.com, host of Rising on Hill TV as well. Robbie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice to talk with you.
Content with what Nick Clegg had to say about Facebook's content moderation policies? And as to the question of their collaboration with government, he said, we frustrate governments more often than not by refusing to do what they want us to do. So their posture is for free and open debate, except when the independent fact checkers say no.
Right. I'm incredibly frustrated with the content moderation policies at our major social media companies, as are many users, citizens. We have learned so much more from the Twitter files and various disclosures about just how much bad moderation was being done at the encouragement of government and at the behest of government. I do think it is a fair point, however, in parsing all this, to see that they did push back somewhat in some cases. So the Hunter Biden case is not a case of pushback, right? They did that of their own volition, and it was a bad decision. Twitter then later tried to justify it, for instance. But in a lot of the other cases, you do see from the Twitter files, right, that like the FBI will say to Twitter, for instance, this is Russian disinformation. You got to take this down. And at first, Twitter says, no, we've looked at this. It's nothing. It's not a big deal. You're overplaying this. And then it got more threatening. And it got, if you don't do anything about this, you're harming democracy. We think major media corporations and Democratic politicians will have something to say about that. And then finally, they start going along. With Facebook and COVID stuff, it was much more willing than that. But look, there is an issue here in that a lot of the bad stuff seems to me that was actually very much coercive from the government's perspective.
In what way? Can you explain?
Yeah. As I just said with the Twitter files, you see in the FBI emails to Twitter, them saying, look, here is Russian disinformation. You have to do something about it. And Twitter saying, this isn't really Russian disinformation. And then them saying, we're going to tell Politico you're not taking misinformation seriously. Oh. And at the same time, you have political figures railing against these companies publicly. Joe Biden in July of 2021 said Facebook is killing people because it doesn't moderate more content relating to COVID. He said that. And then his communications, one of his communications people, Kate Bedingfield, I believe her name is, she went on TV and said, if they don't take what our criticism more seriously, we should change Section 230, which is the statute that has to do with how much liability they have for content on the platform. They were basically saying, if you don't do what we say, we're going to look at having punitive regulation hit you. So, you can be as frustrated with the social media companies as you want. And to be clear, I am very frustrated. But they were definitely between a rock and a hard place. They were definitely looking at being this, at least the hint, more than the hint, of being punished for not doing what the administration wanted.
Right. Although what comes across to the Twitter files and what comes across even from some pronouncements Mark Zuckerberg has made is a disposition of collaboration. Their default is to collaborate, is to listen, rather than saying, we're not in the business of taking our marching orders from you at the FBI or CDC. They go on, as Nick Clegg did with Brett Baer, and say, we're a private company and this and that and so forth. We make our own decisions. But the feel of those Twitter files, the feel of what the emails between the CDC and Facebook that you wrote about is a default position to try to accommodate. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. I mean, these are hard it's hard to tell exactly what their thinking is. Yes, I think they're staffed disproportionately by people who are very amenable to this, who want to be good citizens and define good citizenship as, you know, kind of reflexively listening to what federal officials and federal health officials and maybe federal law enforcement have to say. At the same time, they're being held hostage a little bit. Everyone in politics is railing against them. I mean, Republicans want to regulate these companies for censoring too much content, right? And Democrats want to regulate them for not restricting enough content. So they have no right. friends in politics, and it's really hard.
Well, but the problem is they're playing politics rather than going back to their original mission statement, something even Jack Dorsey conceded. Well, after his ouster, that, our original mission statement was this, and they strayed away from it. If you would have said, look, we are a free marketplace of ideas, that's who we said we were going to be, we're going to be that. And if you don't like those discussions, then we understand you don't like them. But we said this is who we're going to be. This is who we're going to be, rather than they're sort of swinging back and forth, catering to one side or catering to the other based on where they think their political bread is buttered at any given moment. And that, you know, puts them in the middle of the road, getting hit by traffic going both ways.
Yeah, I think that's basically what happened. And I mean, they've been called the leaders of these companies, Zuckerberg and Dorsey back when he was in charge, and et cetera. You know, they've been hauled before Congress multiple times to be yelled at by members of both parties, who are somewhat advanced in their age and have, I think, to be charitable, only a tenuous grasp of the technologies involved, you know, being told, why haven't you done this and why haven't you done that, from people who don't even understand it. That's something we can't totally write off, even as we express, I think, very legitimate frustration with choices they made with respect to election stuff and COVID and Hunter Biden, which, you know, is so indefensible. They admitted it was indefensible. They've admitted that was a very, very bad call. And I think that was freely chosen. And I think Facebook outsourced all of their COVID moderation policies essentially to the CDC itself. Yep. In ways that are very alarming.
Well, on Twitter, they even refer to them as their coworkers, Twitter employees who are going back and forth with the CDC. It's ridiculous. So right now, is big tech still being run by big government?
Yes. Yes, it's being, I think, absolutely. But is it being run by big government because big government is holding a loaded gun to their head and saying, do this? Yeah, we're not saying you have to. We're just saying that, you know, nice company you have there. It'd be a shame if someone regulated it out of existence or broke it up. And by the way, there's an entire, you know, panel of bureaucrats and people who are perfectly willing to do that. Just say the word. Just say you're going to go against us. I think their decision making has to be seen in that light.
Well, the irony about Biden is, you know, Facebook is killing people. I wouldn't say this, but I mean, the irony of the statement is that to the extent Facebook was, quote unquote, killing people, it was by preventing debate and preventing people from asking legitimate questions and getting answers, or even if they were competing answers from equally credentialed experts. That prevention led to people filling in their own blanks and based on their politics of what is judicious and what is not judicious. And maybe they weren't always making the best choices because Joe Biden and his folks at CDC were suppressing debate.
Yeah, I mean, does the CDC have anything better to do with its time than, you know, dictate to Facebook what should appear on the platform? They're very much too online, the whole Biden administration, thinking the COVID policy hinges on what you're allowed to discuss on Facebook. I mean, we all know that the CDC, you know, screwed up, especially in the early days, so many times. They screwed up the testing rollout. They prohibited tests that would have worked fine in order to have their own centralized test that then didn't work. I feel similarly, frankly, about some of these law enforcement officials that are spend all day apparently flagging obnoxious tweets for Twitter moderators. Like, don't you have every time there's a mass shooting, we find out the person was known to the FBI already. Maybe follow up on some of those leads instead of like play on Twitter all day. Huh? How about that?
Yeah,
that sounds good to me.
But one of the more infamous examples of this, too, to your point about CDC, was this exchange between Collins and Fauci about trying to silence doctors and scientists that were associated with the Great Barrington Declaration, you know, the epidemiologists from Harvard and Oxford, rather than just engage. And if Jay Bhattacharya or Martin Kulldorff has something you disagree with, then disagree with them publicly, as opposed to trying to use your power at CDC to silence them altogether.
Yeah, and it's treating these subjects like there can be no debate. And look, to be clear, Facebook took down content that I think is totally relating to COVID and other things that I think is totally crazy and has no legitimacy. But it also cut off debate on you know, whether it was possible that COVID emerged from a lab, whether the vaccine should be authorized for children, you know, given the children don't have a particularly statistically bad time with COVID, and what are the benefits there, and various other topics. And I feel like this, and I think many people feel like this, that it is healthy to debate and discuss many of these topics on social media, and that just turning the off switch to all that stuff actually made people more paranoid about various COVID topics. Because when you silence someone, you know, you make them, when you say, we're so afraid of this, we're so afraid of you finding out about this or learning about this or reading this, that's how seductive and powerful and evil this idea is. I think it makes a lot of people more interested in the idea, frankly. I think that's the censor's dilemma.
What do you think about, so now the Department of Justice is going after Google to try to, you know, have them break off their ad piece of their business. Is that going to have an additional chilling effect in terms of big tech's willingness to push back against government agencies? Then we're going to be the next one facing antitrust suits.
Yeah, I think, frankly, yes. And many conservatives who want to defend free speech, I think, are falling into a bad trap of supporting some of these government actions being taken against the tech companies. Again, the major problem is that government actors, federal bureaucrats, political figures are threatening these companies into doing things that I think are bad. You know, trying to handle it on the company end is, I think, not a good approach and risks making the problem worse. Like, wait, if we break up Google, how does that, well, you could have several entities that all have bad speech policies because they're all being yelled at by the federal government. If you raise their liability, why they would take down more stuff. That's the worst solution of all, is this changing this Section 230 statute, which many conservatives want to do, but it would make them. It would make it so you could sue Facebook, for instance, if I post a libelous comment on Facebook. Right now, you can sue me, you can't sue Facebook. That's the way the law works. They want to change that. But, I mean, I think the, like, obvious implication of that would be then Facebook's not going to let me post at will or anyone, or just verified users. There'd be some kind of vetting process. That seems like a vast silencing would take place under so many of these policies. So I'm very much against them. We have to correct it on the government end, not on the tech end.
He is Robbie Suave, senior editor at Reason, Reason.com, host of Rising at Hill TV as well. Robbie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open my.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's that time of the week. Open Mic Friday. Mm-hmm. Taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Comments, compliments, concerns, criticisms, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. Amy, would you like to offer anything?
You know, I'm just girding my loins to see what's going to happen today in reference to the video that's going to be out in the Memphis beating. And then also Paul Pelosi, the body camera video is going to be released on that.
Hammer time.
Oh,
can't touch this.
Yeah, because Nancy Pelosi, I don't think she said that she might not be able to watch it. And there might be other reasons why she won't be able to watch it. But I don't know. But we'll just find out the truth, because NBC News FOIA'd the information. They FOIA'd the body cam video, the police body cam video, and other things. So I'll be released today, folks. And then
I offer up Aaron Rodgers. I know there's probably some Bears fans and COVIDians that don't like him, but he was on his buddy Pat McAfee's podcast again. I think he appears weekly on that show. And he talked a little bit about the press coverage since his season ended, all the trade rumors about Aaron Rodgers, and how the sports media covers him. And I thought this was a really good perspective. You could make the same case for a non-COVIDian Paul or person and their treatment from the larger press corps. Take a listen.
There's heroes and villains in sports and entertainment. And I think because of my stance on COVID and maybe some other things, I've been cast as the villain, especially the last few years. Yep. And so that is the way that, you know, a lot of things I said are often interpreted. I'm not upset about that. I don't feel like a victim in any way. I don't have that mentality. That's fine. I actually embraced that role a little bit. That's how you want to cast me. But I did see there were some comments that, you know, I'm only playing for MVPs and stuff like that. Didn't maybe quite see the entire clip of some of the stuff that I said. I don't care about that stuff. It doesn't offend me. I mean, this culture, this woke culture wants to be offended by everything. You just go online and find something you don't agree with. I'm offended. How could you possibly say that? Yes. I don't really care. I don't care who it's coming from or who said it. They're entitled to their opinion. It might not be right. And every now and then you got to get on here and say, hey, you know, you just found some bullshit. Like, that's just not true. Like, let's just tone it back a little bit. You might need to do that. Most of the time, you just kind of gloss over it. Who cares? It doesn't really matter. Because it honestly doesn't matter. It doesn't affect my day-to-day. It doesn't interrupt my whale-watching time. It doesn't interrupt me at all during the day. I don't think, you know, agonize about, like, oh, you know, Gronk said, you know, I shouldn't be worrying about MVPs. I'm like, I know Gronk. I love Gronk. He's awesome. He's fun energy to be around. Like, but what do they do? You know, if you take us, if you take the right sound bite from the right thing, you know, and it's a station that may or may not have in the past been brought to you by Pfizer, then they got to make sure that their villain, you know, gets cast in the correct light. And whether or not they're, you know, sponsored by Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, whatever it might be.
What?
When you go up against some of those powers that be, you put yourself in the crosshairs. You know, they're going to paint you in a certain way. And that's what the media did to me a couple of years ago. That's fine. That's their prerogative. That's what they wanted to do. But I think I responded, you know, pretty good in those times. And I'm glad I went through that. And anything that comes after that, small potatoes, bro.
How can you not like Aaron Rodgers?
I love him. And people just vilified him and on so many levels because he wouldn't get vaccinated.
It's a sad commentary. It's so sick. Sad commentary on our society where Aaron Rodgers has more political courage than members of the clergy.
Yep.
Sad commentary. All right. Take a couple calls here. That is the point of the segment. Bob in Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Always good talking to you. Earlier this morning, your news segment mentioned the passing of an NBA player, but I don't believe you or Mike Scott mentioned another death. Dan, aren't you a White Sox fan?
I am a White Sox fan.
Well, before you were born, there was the 1967 season.
Yes.
Gary Peters was on that staff, and he passed away. Peters was part of that great, phenomenal pitching staff of Horland and a very young Tommy John. That team almost took the pennant. That team almost took the pennant. They had a phenomenal ERA, but no hitting. And then
Tommy John, famously known for the Tommy John surgery.
Tommy John surgery. Yeah.
Oh, right.
And then Sunday. At the end of the season, the Sox went into Kansas City to play the Royals. It was pretty much not a done deal, but Kansas City was the one of the worst teams in baseball. The Sox were going to win a doubleheader. Unfortunately, they lost a doubleheader, and that ended their pennant chance. And
thank you,
Gary Peters. Yes. Have a great day.
Thank you, Hawk Harrelson, for that moment in White Sox history. Appreciate it. All, yeah,
love you, Bob.
Speaking of sports, that's Billy Packer. That was mentioned by Mike Scott. Yeah, Billy Packer. He was a good color analyst. I liked him doing college basketball games. We still have Bill Raftery, but Billy Packer was good too.
Okay.
Jordan Antioch.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Hey, in light of everything that's going on with this
the assault weapons ban, and now our president calling for a ban, and Chuck Schumer and everybody. I know there's people that listen on the other side of the aisle, maybe people that aren't quite as educated as people that are passionate about as myself and others. But for those that aren't kind of educated or know what's going on with this, I really encourage people to look up a couple things in the past, a thing called Operation Wide Receiver, and another thing called Operation Fast and Furious, where our ATF, DEA, right, where our Justice Department, our ATF, and our DEA armed, now they didn't want to take claim for it, they used the Arizona ATF, but they armed the cartel with over 600 assault weapons to try to track them coming back through straw purchases. Now, to my knowledge, not one has been claimed, but one agent, Officer Brian Terry, was killed by one of those weapons. And there's a good chance that the way things circulate, you never know the way the lottery works, is you may know somebody that's been shot with one of these weapons. Now, so I encourage everybody to do a little homework. The other thing I encourage them to do is, if they're a Democrat and they voted for this, I encourage them to call their representative and ask them why, under two presidents that have complete control over Congress, that have Democrat control, they never passed an assault weapons ban. They never passed any kind of gun control. Ask them that. When they had the majority, when they could ramrod Obamacare through, they never did one thing about guns. And ask them to give you an honest answer about that. The other thing I ask is that you just educate yourself and you start to look into these things and do a little deeper dive to realize what they're pushing. It's control. It's not safety. It's control and it's money. And I think everybody should make informed decisions and realize what it is that they're pushing that they won't enforce and that they don't really want. Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Jordan.
I got a text message.
Yeah.
Remember when the city of Chicago would have amnesty days for parking tickets? Well, maybe the Justice Department should have top secret document amnesty days. For the next 30 days, you can turn in your classified document.
That's right.
That's good.
That's one way to get them collected.
Yeah.
Joe in Arlington Heights, our poet laureate.
Good morning. Another awesome week for you two. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, this is no fun limerick like My Name It Is Lightfoot, which we did some several months ago, but this one's called How a State Dies. I saw this picture of on Fox News on the phone app, a headshot of Pritzker next to a headshot of DeSantis, and it just, something sparked. So I sat down last night and I wrote this. How a state dies. There was an extra fat man who lorded over Lincoln's land. Dictatorship was his game in his quest for presidential fame. He knew what was best on the woman's rights test, that babies shall die until the day they open their eyes. On gender fantasy too, for nothing but compliance will do. Yes, the extra fat man bought into queer theory's plan, but care did he not, while states of emergency won't stop, the state's constitution he fought, while judges he bought. He pursued his self-righteous plans, trying to disarm every man, and lied at each turn, looking away while Chicago did burn. So this is the tale of a once great state. For Illinois, it's probably too late. We have learned to comply, which is all it takes for a state to die.
Wow.
That
wow.
is how a all state right, dies.
Yeah, it's conjures images of Edgar Allan Poe. Thanks for the call, Joe. Very dark.
Hardly, but thanks, thanks for puffing me up.
Thanks for the call. Speaking of Edgar Allan Poe, maybe he's top of mind because have you seen the new movie with Christian Bale and the guy from the Harry Potter movies? I'm blanking on his name now, who plays Edgar Allan Poe. Pale Blue Eye. It's on Netflix.
Is it good?
It's good. Very good.
Worth
well, Christian
watch.
Christian Bale's always good. This this guy who's who plays Edgar Allan Poe, who's in the Harry Potter movies, I mean, he was outstanding. Great performance. It's a good movie. That's worth checking out. A little dark, but, you know.
Have you watched That 90s Show?
That 90s Show? No.
It's great. I love it. The first episode is brutal because you're wondering why these new people are in your characters' bedrooms and houses and things like that. But
what's the premise?
Oh, it's from That 70s Show. It's called That 90s Show. It's the same.
That
70s Kitty
Show.
Foreman, they're there, and they have their grandchild comes to live with them.
Oh, gosh.
No, it's good. It's
the 70s. You like The 70s Show?
I love that show.
Did you still have the poster of Topher Grace in your bedroom? That show sucks.
But it's good. That 90s show is really good. You just have to get through the first episode, and then there's surprises and cameos throughout the series.
Don't listen to Amy. Listen to me. Watch Pale Blue Eye with your
entertainment time. But if you want some, mind-numbing things, you can watch that 90s show.
Mike in Lakeview.
Good morning, everybody. Kind of tough following E.E. Cummings, but wanted to say that I'm leaning toward Vallis, but I'm slowly becoming a whitey for Willie. But here's my concern. If either of those two guys gets elected, and you've got 10 Marxists in the city council, probably another 5 going to get elected in April or next month, whichever you prefer, what kind of cooperation are they going to get? That's comment number one. Comment number two, I think you need to recruit Philip from Blue Island and Tom from Long Grove to have a Wokies for Willie group to be started. Maybe get some of the liberals to vote for him.
Thanks for the call, Mike. And the whole city council cooperation, like, oh, how are you going to work with the General Assembly if you're a Republican governor and the Democrats control the General Assembly? I don't know. It's going to be issue by issue. We're going to have to build coalitions around my policy agenda, not theirs. Because what is the point of having somebody who can work with the city council if they're a bunch of Marxists? Who cares who the mayor is then? And if it becomes if there are fights, finally, the city council has been a rubber stamp for the past 50 years. There should be fights. And if things are brought to a halt, good. For the most part, things being brought to a halt in government in this state is progress. So the whole, you have the comment, as Ray Lopez was telling us this morning, the possibility of a sort of a common sense caucus between that would be formed with him and Spezzato and Gardner and Napolitano and hopefully some others. It's all about aligning interests around particular issues. Who cares if the out and proud Marxists of the city council don't want to cooperate with you? By the way, even though you have this city council, in practice, Chicago's a strong mayor form of government, isn't it? You can accomplish a lot as mayor, even with a recalcitrant city council. And if it's Beirut by the lake, like it was in the 80s under Harold Washington, then let's fight it out. Either the city's worth fighting for or it isn't. David in Lansing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I was wondering if either of you still have a Facebook account.
Yeah, I do. I don't post very much, but I have an account, yeah.
Okay. Did you know that if you don't necessarily have to give somebody money or a website money, you could just go to the website and that increases traffic. When you increase traffic, that company that owns a website can charge more for advertising. So you're kind of indirectly giving Mark Zuckerberg money. Remember when you threw the election, or you helped throw it by spending $400 million on drop boxes a couple years ago?
I do remember.
Well, by going to Facebook, you're helping Mark Zuckerberg throw more elections. Have a nice day.
All right, David.
Stay away from Facebook.
Well, the whole boycott everything. Yeah, that's not the play. It's just not. It's not a feasible strategy. Sorry. Speaking of Facebook, Rich, Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Just have a quick question. Is there any upside for Trump going back on Facebook after 2 years? Guys, have a nice weekend.
Going to help Mark Zuckerberg throw elections. It's a communication platform.
But will it, did he sign a contract about his Truth Social that he can't do any other social media posts?
I don't pretend to know the particulars of that SPAC, but how effective was he using Twitter? And Twitter puts money into the pockets of, well, now Elon Musk, but previously, and when Trump was ascendant, it was Jack Dorsey and, by extension, the left, as we see from the Twitter files and the spy agencies. So is Trump operating against interests? No, not really. He was able to reach a lot of people around the legacy media, wasn't he?
Yep.
Eduardo in Chicago.
Doing a back bend over there?
Yeah, stretching.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. The COVID thing and the flu shot, they're not supposed to be taken at the same time. They had an article in the Daily Mail because it, there's an increase in stroke. And check this book out for the young people, 50 Jobs, 50 States, Daniel Siddiqui. I should have called this in last time.
50 Jobs, 50 States.
Yeah.
There, and we should check it out because why? What's the thesis?
Well, young people change jobs after 1 week, so this would be good for them, and then they can write a book.
Okay. Oh, this is what he did. He did 50 jobs in 50 states.
Right,
I got it.
Right.
A personal journey. All right. Thanks, Eduardo. Chuck and Delavan to close her out.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you, everyone, for coming to visit the bottle shop. I'm not sitting in the bottle shop. I'm not allowed to drink when my girlfriend's working, Kathleen. But I want to give a shout-out. When I was at your birthday party, I went and I met this really nice couple, Phil and Reggie. And I want to give a shout-out to them. They sold their house in Illinois. Now they live up here by Lake Geneva. So don't forget next week, we got the big winter festival up here in Lake Geneva. Come up and freeze your buns off. It's going to be exciting.
Thank you, Chuck. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.